ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
This year's Big Dallas Conference on Science and Faith is packed with great speakers highlighting powerful evidence for intelligent design. And this year, there's an in-person option as well as an option to live stream. You choose. Speakers are Stephen Meyer, Brazilian superstar chemist Marcus Eberlin, author Melissa Kane Travis, geologist Casey Leskin, and ID pioneer William Dembski. The conference is Saturday, February 20th. The cost is $20. For more details and to register, go to discovery.org/Dallas2021. That's discovery.org/Dallas2021. Don't miss this unique opportunity to explore the rich interface between science and faith. Register now at discovery.org/Dallas2021.
Welcome to this episode of ID the Future. I am Discovery Institute Senior Fellow Jay Richards, and we have a special episode for you today. Really is a kind of a combination of Darwin Day and Black History Month. We almost always talk annually about Darwin Day, but actually Darwin Day and Black History Month, they are sort of coincident. And we actually want to talk about the connection between those two things. You might think they're unrelated, but they're not. And so we want to talk about that this time around. Of course, the last summer has seen, at least in the United States, a lot of racial tension, especially between Black Americans and white Americans, with toppling statues and attacks on historic white male icons. And Darwin has, in fact, even himself been swept into it. And with that, we're not going to take any particular view on those topics. But of course, the question of Darwinism and Darwin himself is directly related to the purview of ID the Future. And so we want to talk about that, including the skeletons in Darwin's closet, and sometimes the skeletons that scholars don't want you to know are in Darwin's closet. And there's really no better person I could think of to talk about those skeletons than historian of science, Michael Flannery, who many of you know has been a longtime fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He's actually a professor emeritus of the UAB libraries at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He holds degrees in library science. He's written extensively on the history of medicine and science. In fact, he's done really important work on the co-discoverer of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace. In particular, we'll talk about his book from 2011 with Discovery Institute Press, Alfred Russel Wallace, A Rediscovered Life. But before we get started, Michael, thanks so much for joining me.
Well, it's great to be here, Jay.
Yeah, we talked about how we used to see each other periodically when I was full-time at Discovery Institute in Seattle, and haven't seen you in years, so it's nice to reconnect. Yeah. We're all getting old. I can't believe how many years we've been at this, unfortunately. Right. Oh, and you're Professor Emeritus. At least I'm not yet a Professor Emeritus. So.
Yeah, Professor Emeritus means I'm old. That's exactly what that means.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about Darwin, especially because of this coincidence of Black History Month and Darwin Day. And you actually have a piece up at Evolution News actually talking about Darwin and race. And the piece is called Three Strikes, He's Out. So I recommend people go see that at Evolution News. But just in a nutshell, what's the knock on Darwin in terms of his view of Black and other non-white races, really?
Well, in a nutshell, for Darwin, Blacks and other non-white races were inferior, to put it quite simply. And to give you an example, when he saw the Fuegan natives traveling on the Beagle around Cape Horn in December of 1832, he called them poor wretches. And he said, oh, they seem more animal than human. He was just shocked and appalled at them. And he may have come to believe in common descent, but that never really translated into anything approaching racial or ethnic equality. He told the Reverend Charles Kingsley in 1862 that the so-called higher races of men would replace and clear off the lower races. And years later, just before his death, he told William Graham that the world at no very distant date would find an endless number of lower races will have been eliminated by the higher civilized races throughout the world. So for Darwin, evolution meant human progress, but it was a progress seen through a distinct lens of British Empire and of Anglo-centric superiority.
Well, okay, that, I guess, raises the question because, of course, you know, many of us that follow this have heard that chilling quote of Darwin. And I know that the opposing voice would say, well, Darwin was, he wasn't celebrating it. He was sort of describing nature red and tooth and claw. And of course, Darwin was a British gentleman of the 19th century, as you said, at the height of the British Empire. He was a Victorian. And so certainly he held racist views by our standard, but wasn't he just sort of a, you know, kind of an ordinary person? Besides which, he was actually known to be opposed to slavery, which would at the time have made him very progressive, presumably. So, I mean, how would you respond? Is he just, you know, sort of parroting the typical views of the time, or is it more to it?
I do think there's more to it. And I think it's true, Darwin was opposed to slavery, but primarily because he thought it degraded the white race.
Hmm.
He was really ahead of his time, I guess, in that literal sense, but within the context, I don't think he really was. You know, even his great apologists, Adrian Desmond and James Moore, wrote a book a few years back called Darwin's Sacred Cause.
Mm-hmm.
And even they, at the end of the book, after going through pages and pages, chapter and chapter, of Darwin and his commitment to anti-slavery, they say this: Darwin ended up calibrating human rank no differently than the rest of his generation. True, he was opposed to slavery, wow. But that
so,
didn't...
So that is extraordinary, because if all you heard was that he was... anti-slavery, that'd be the sort of the end of the story, but there's definitely more to it.
Well, he was certainly no proponent of the equality of the white race with the black race. And I don't think we can hang much praise on a man who opposes slavery on those terms, in effect saying, oh, I oppose slavery because it makes my race look bad.
Wow. Yeah, it's a completely different angle that I don't think it's really counterintuitive. It would never have occurred to me. But so how did Darwin compare, you know, to his near contemporary Alfred Russel Wallace then?
Yeah. Well, I think some historians will say, well, he was a product of his time. And, you know, we ought to give him a pass because his entire generation sort of felt that way. But, you know, we can pick out or identify people of his own generation who felt quite differently. And one of them, surprisingly enough, was the co-founder of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace. He really viewed indigenous peoples very, very differently from Darwin. Now, you have to remember that from the spring of 1848 to October of 1852, he lived, and I mean literally lived, with South American Indians. And then when he spent 1854 to 1862, you know, roughly 8 years in the Malay archipelago, he lived with Dayak hunters in Borneo and many other people of what we now know today as the Southeast Asian Maritimes.
Mm-hmm.
This was in stark contrast to Darwin, who for 5 years never really strayed far from the Beagle or from Captain Fitzroy. Hmm. Instead, we've got 12 to 13 years of Alfred Russel Wallace living intimately with indigenous people, fascinated by their culture, wanting to know about their culture. And Wallace once remarked, he said, "For nearly 12 years, I traveled and lived mostly among uncivilized and completely savage races." By that, he just meant people who were, you know, non-Western Europe. He says, right. "And I became convinced that they all possessed good qualities, some of them in very remarkable degree, and that in all the great characteristics of humanity, they are wonderfully like ourselves. Mm-hmm. Some are declared by numerous independent and unprejudiced observers," he said, "to be both physically, morally, and intellectually our equals, if not our superiors."
Wow.
Now, you'll never get anything like that from Darwin.
No, that's extraordinary. I mean, right in the middle of the 19th century, and that his views were formed not by kind of an abstract view, but I mean, actually from by his direct experience with these native peoples. That sort of speaks very well of Wallace. I'll remind listeners, of course, that Wallace is credited with the co-discovery of natural selection along with Darwin. Unlike Darwin, he thought natural selection only explained some things, right? He held a teleological view of biology.
He did very much. And in fact, he wrote a book on that subject called The World of Life. And he really developed what I have called the theory of intelligent evolution, the idea that evolution is not blind, but that it is guided and purposeful. And that was a very, of course, starkly different view from what Darwin came to believe in. And in fact, I mean, if you think about this book that he wrote toward the end of his life around 1910, the subtitle of that book really says it all. It's called The World of Life, A Manifestation of Creative Power, Directive Mind, and Ultimate Purpose. Wow. Now, would anything like that ever have come from the pen of Charles Darwin? No, I mean, I just, you know, our listeners can ask themselves that question. And I think it's quite clear it wouldn't have.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's the perfect contrast. Well, we've talked a bit about Darwin himself, Darwin the man, his own personal views. But of course, there's this kind of second question, which is Darwin's theory, which he proposed. And his theory has a life of its own, apart from his private views. And so I'm wondering the kind of effects of Darwinism, for instance, the role that it had in racist eugenics, for instance, which of course emerged and was its heyday in the United States in the 1920s and the 1930s. I mean, you think Darwin's theory, I mean, clearly it's almost as a softball question as I could possibly ask you, but what about the role of the theory in the emergence, not of racism per se, of course, racism is unfortunately a blight on human history, but on this so-called scientific racist eugenics?
Well, let's remember when we're talking about this, that I think one of the fundamental, I would view it as mistake, I would view it as a fundamentally flawed worldview, but one of the essential problems with Charles Darwin's theory really makes itself evident, and not so much in his Origin of Species, it's there, but not abundantly clear. The fundamental flaw becomes abundantly clear in his 1871 Descent of Man. And there, Darwin really says that man is different from animal only in degree, but not kind. And what he's really doing is flying in the face of human exceptionalism. And he's saying, look, we are just, you know, higher forms of animals, more or less. Now, let's connect that with one of his fundamental analogies. In fact, he opens his first chapter of Origin of Species with the breeding of pigeons.
Right.
Domestic breeding examples. And so if he felt that, gee, look what we can do with the breeding of livestock, breeding more elaborate pigeons, why not apply these principles to human breeding? And now, Darwin never said that openly, but he certainly left the door open for his cousin, Francis Galton, to make that connection. And he did. And really, the father of eugenics is Francis Galton. And this was really a pretty horrific abuse of what was then considered science, which you almost can't say without putting scare quotes around it. Galton felt that these domestic breeding practices could be applied to nature by Darwin's own analogy. And this could be done by encouraging proper marriages, defined, of course, by the eugenicists themselves, and conversely, by sterilizing, by force if necessary, those deemed by the eugenicists as unfit. And in fact, on this so-called scientific idea or notion, more than 65,000 Americans were sterilized. It's really one of the most shameful chapters in human history.
And it lends itself to this. I mean, this is the thing is that even apart from the fact that Darwin himself perhaps didn't extend his theory in this way, the very, as you said, opening chapter of The Origin, it lends itself to this kind of intellectual analysis. Look, if we can breed chickens, if we can breed other animals, why can't we breed humans and improve the stock in that way?
And the direct connection is made by the eugenicists themselves. The two leading American geneticists of the day was Paul Popenoe and Roswell Hill Johnson, who said quite clearly in their work, frightfully called Applied Eugenics, that the science of eugenics, as they put it, was the natural result of the spread and acceptance of organic evolution as propounded by Darwin's work, The Origin of Species. They come right out and openly say this. So I know a lot of Darwin's apologists try to distance Darwin from its social applications, but that was never the case, either by Darwin or Francis Galton or the eugenicists who actually applied those principles in their careers. So I think the connection there is pretty strong and pretty unsettling.
It is. And so I'm really, there's the first way then, I think, in which Darwinism played into eugenics is, of course, just this basic analogy of breeding of animals. But then, of course, there's this more fundamental kind of metaphysical level at which, if you think about the sort of alternative to Darwin's theory, certainly at the time, this idea that all human beings are made in the image of God, and so we derive intrinsic dignity and equality and value precisely because of our status, whatever our race or our capacities, that Darwin's kind of thoroughly naturalistic or really materialistic view of humans also undercut, I honestly think, the only really stable metaphysical foundation for human equality itself, don't you think?
I think you're absolutely correct, and therein lies the problem. And a whole host of untoward consequences flow from that. And we have, you know, this Darwin Day coming up and ironically appearing in the midst of Black History Month. And What a stark contrast between Darwin, the man, and his times, the theory he developed, and the consequences that it wrought right in the midst of struggles for racial equality and all the rest.
Well, and, you know, I'm just reminded that Martin Luther King Jr. himself saw this connection. He made actually a similar point. In fact, I remember there was a piece last month when we celebrated Martin Luther King Day that made this point. He saw this connection between scientific racism and scientific materialism that, not properly scientific, but this kind of claim really undercuts this idea of human value and equality, of this intrinsic dignity and exceptionalism of humanity. Now, having said that, of course, I know you don't think this. I don't think that because Darwin's own ideas and Darwinism has these odious cultural consequences, therefore we think Darwinism is false. It's not that simple, obviously, right? But I mean, this is still relevant, right? I mean, I would think at the very least that this should, you know, give people pause before they just immediately accommodate the theory.
It should, and it should give them pause in this way. Let us remember that Darwin's views on race were not just his personal opinions that, you know, he came to hold maybe because he was a product of his times or whatever, but that Darwin's view of non-Western peoples, let's say, was actually tied to various aspects of his theory. Mm-hmm. And so when he's talking about what nature can do, he's tying what nature can do directly to what he sees happens to animals in domestic breeding experiments. And so it's not a big leap to go from that to a systematic program of eugenics. Also, remember that Darwin makes his own argument for categorizing different ethnic groups of people on the basis of the totally discredited so-called science of craniotomy. And he cites J. Bernard Davis and Paul Broca, who were the two leading ethnologists of their day. And he was convinced that they had proved that ethnic groups could be ranked hierarchically literally by the cubic inches of their brain cases. And people, you know, you talk about putting some flesh on the skeleton. Well, here's some flesh on the skull, that they literally would fill crania with beads and then count them up. Wow. And the one with the most wins. And what he had actually done, and you can read about this in Descent of Man, is he had actually categorized different ethnic groups on the basis of their cranial capacity.
Yeah, and of course, we saw that the kind of basic idea, of course, later in some of Haeckel's diagrams and some very sort of obviously racist texts, all of which were treated as sort of properly scientific, honestly, I think if it had not been for Nazism, the eugenics might not still have been discredited. No one now wants to be associated with it. And so, of course, it makes sense that Darwin apologists would do their best to distance him. But this conversation, I think, has revealed quite clearly that it's not so easy to separate the chaff from the wheat. Well, I want to recommend a couple of resources to listeners, Michael. So certainly your terrific book, Alfred Russel Wallace, which is available at Discovery Institute. Also, your piece actually up right now talking about this at Evolution News and Views, Darwin and Race, Three Strikes, He's Out. And then this documentary that Discovery did a few years back, really terrific, grim and sobering, called Human Zoos, American's Forgotten History of Scientific Racism. And actually, listeners, if you go to Michael's piece at Evolution News and Views, we have Human Zoos at YouTube linked to the bottom. So, Michael Flannery, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Jay. Appreciate it.
And this is Jay Richards with the Discovery Institute. Thank you for joining us.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.